Welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I'm Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader.
And here we are, almost an hour in, 59th minute, or coming into, this is the 60th minute, actually. And we're going to talk about some things we all have in common. We're going to compare relative knowledge of a certain group within the Marvel Universe. So, Hal, why don't you get us up to speed on what's going on in minute 59?
All right, minute 59. A great title for this one, but I guess I won't say it because that gives away a line. Inside the Hydra factory's grim cell block, Dum-Dum Dugan, a burly prisoner of the 107th wearing a worn bowler hat, slows as the group shuffles into their cell. A Hydra guard jabs him in the back with a stick, prompting a defiant glare. "You know, Fritz, one of these days I'm going to have a stick of my own," Dugan mutters, his voice gruff. The guard, unfazed, slams the prison door shut. In the murky Austrian forest, Steve Rogers moves stealthily toward the Hydra factory. Twin searchlight beams sweep from a guard tower, cutting through the darkness. Suddenly, a convoy of trucks rumbles out of the night. Steve ducks low along the roadside, then leaps into the back of one truck. He lands silently, only to find himself facing a platoon of Hydra soldiers seated in the truck bed, their masked faces turning toward him. Steve flashes a tight grin. "Fellas?" Rogers grabs several of the nearest soldiers and hurls them out the back, their bodies tumbling into the dark as the convoy rolls into the Hydra comp ground. I'm going to take that. It's not a comp ground or a compound.
It's a compound.
It's a compound. I'm going to take that again, and Jim's going to leave this in to make me look stupid.
Of course I am. No, just make you look very careful and wanting to be a perfectionist.
All right. Rogers grabs several of the nearest soldiers and hurls them out the back, their bodies tumbling into the dark as the convoy rolls into the Hydra compound.
That's beautiful.
That feels better.
That's a great take, too. Wow. So much going on in this. But we're introduced, basically into the concept of the Howling Commandos, at least the first of them, with Dum-Dum Dugan. There's so much history going on here and so much stuff happening and names and people and things. I want to get into it, but Brian, we could get into a little bit more about the comic history behind here. Could you talk a little bit about, Nick Fury and how he doesn't fit in?
Because there's a fascinating difference between the comics and the movies here. I just want to say, first of all, I love this minute of the movie just because it's almost slapstick with Steve beating the soldiers up in the back of the truck, and all you see is the boom bada boom through the canvas of the truck as
there should be bam
shoot
and pow
out the back with almost a slide whistle sound as they go through the fabric in the back. It's just a really nice kind of almost something you'd seen in a Warner Brothers cartoon. So I really enjoyed that. But it's interesting because this minute and the presence of the Howling Commandos illustrates the difference between when Marvel Comics got started in the early 60s versus, the early 2000s, 2010, so forth, when these movies were made, because in 1960, 61, 62, it hadn't been that long since World War II. And people like Jack Kirby had fought in World War II and based their stories about the Howling Commandos on them. So in the early days, Nick Fury was Sergeant Fury. Sergeant Fury was created in 1963 to lead the Howling Commandos. It was Sergeant Fury and his Howling Commandos. Nick Fury was their leader. They couldn't do that for the movies because too much time had passed. So the comic book history of Nick Fury is he was introduced first as this Sergeant Fury in these tales of World War II. And then that was 1963. Shortly afterwards, August 65, Stan Lee and Jack Kirby updated him. And now they're telling the stories of Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. S.H.I.E.L.D. was invented in 65. In our universe, and so what they were doing there is they're playing off the whole James Bond trend and tropes, and what was really hot then was all the new James Bond stuff that was new and exciting at the time. So it was interesting right from the start. Fury had these two timelines going in the comics. You could read about his adventures in World War II, And you could also read about his adventures in mid-1960s with a 20-year older Nick Fury. It wasn't a problem then. He was 20 years older. So if you say he was maybe 30, 35 in World War II, well, maybe he's 50, 55 in 1963, 64. It wasn't a problem then. It became a problem later when they came to make these movies. You can't explain how Nick Fury is now all of a sudden 130 years old.
Yeah, so, Grandpa Fury.
Yeah, so they had to excise Fury from the Howling Commandos timeline. Samuel L. Jackson, Nick Fury, never fought in World War II like the original Nick Fury did. He never led the Howling Commandos. So from the comic book readers / scholars point of view, it's really interesting what they had to do with Nick Fury to make him work for modern audiences. And I think they did a nice job of it.
Yeah. It's really interesting to me too, that they sort of bothered to take some of these guys from the 107th and make them, you know, the Howling Commandos from the comics. I mean, they didn't as excited as I was to see them, because it was one of the I'll come back to that in a second, but it just wasn't something that they needed to do. I mean, we could have had Bucky and some other guys and things in there. And, you know, they don't lean too hard into them being the Howling Commandos, except, you know, Neil McDonough is so immediately recognizable as Dum Dum Dugan, who for whatever reason was always my favorite. And when I was a kid, sort of between Star Wars and before I really realized that I liked superhero stuff other than, you know, watching the 60s Batman series in reruns. I wasn't a comic book guy for quite a while, and except when my lifelong buddy Eric Flint, who was Jimmy's been on one of our other shows, and we think he'll be on this one at some point. Somehow he got me into Sergeant Fury and his Howling Commandos. So we'd go to the, you know, used comic book places and find copies and complete our runs and stuff like that and read those. And it was really interesting because they are very straightforward. And I mentioned before the show, I've been rereading them, and I'm 12, 15 issues in now. And they're very, very straightforward. That's just, here's the good guys. You know, the bad guys are obvious. They're the Germans. It's World War II. And there's, you know, there's sort of a mission of the issue and things. But they are just pure fun. You know, the art is very bold. Sometimes it's very simple. Like a lot of the backgrounds are just a single color. And then you've got, little asides, you know, tiny bits of sort of, I don't know, is it the fourth wall in print? But, a little bit of winks at the audience with Stan Lee and Jack Kirby and stuff, they offer some little footnotes, you know, see this issue or wait till you see what happens next time. And then, Corporal Stan says this and Sergeant Jack, or I may have that backwards, but anyway, little nods like that alluding to their own military careers. They are just a ton of fun.
Yeah, and it's funny, at the time, I mean, in the 60s, you know, Brian and I are of an age when the things on TV were matching the tropes of comics. I mean, Sergeant Fury isn't that much different than all the other stuff. We had, growing up, we had Combat, yeah, and Rat Patrol. And Garrison's, yeah, Gorillas. And, you know, and it's like this was every variation. And in the movies, you had the Dirty Dozen, and you had Kelly's Heroes. And it was all kind of like they would take – the not the misanthropes, but the people that didn't, you know, the square pegs. they were always made up a ragtag platoon that conquered the world. And like, you know, none of it made sense. I mean, Rat Patrol was driving around in the desert with nothing to do but fight Eric Braden. And it never ended. The war seemed to go on forever and ever. And it was, I mean, you know, and then, Hal, in your generation, you had MASH, that the series outlasted the war itself by what, a right. decade. So it was, the stories weren't about winning the war. It was about the interpersonal conflicts and things of getting, you always had the guy that was like cowardly. And then one of the main characters would teach them to be brave and do something. And that guy was the one that was the sacrificial lamb that died, but they always remembered him as they were pinning the medal on the casket or whatever. And those stories repeated themselves, but it was okay because this is what you went in for. You went for an escape, whether it took you a half hour on a TV show or a half an hour getting through a comic book.
Well, right. This was the time, 15, 20 years after the end of World War II, when war movies, war TV shows, war comics were a whole subgenre of entertainment. It was like Westerns. It was like, it was just a type of story you told. DC Comics had Sergeant Rock, which couldn't have been more like Sergeant Fury, drawn by the great Joe Kubert, who was very different artist than Jack Kirby, but just right. A wonderful, wonderful artist in his own right. But they're all the same kinds of stories. You're right. And I think part of what you're seeing there are you're seeing people, creators, writers, and artists who were probably kids during World War II. They were in their early 20s, and now they're professional comic book creators, and they're telling stories about things they know, about experiences they had. Not all of them. They didn't all serve, but every citizen who was alive and paying attention in the 40s, had came away affected by the war. And I think it was a way for a lot of them to kind of work that out. And yeah, I think I always compare, and I can't defend this, but so many of these war stories feel like Twilight Zone stories to me too. And there's a little crossover, but they're just these little discrete morality plays, as you said, about good and evil, about cowardice and courage, about doing the right thing in a hard situation. And there was just an awful lot of that in the early 60s, and good stuff. Most of it was good stuff.
Yeah.
One of the things that's really struck me going back and rereading these, that, I wouldn't have thought about this or noticed it as a kid. These are fun and interesting stories, but is how quickly, they establish these characters. I mean, this is not world-changing literature or anything. There's not a ton of depth to it, but with just one or two lines of dialogue early on, you know exactly who everybody is. And the art is vibrant and fun. It's not super detailed, but it does bring like a surprising sort of richness to it. Like it's not that far into that those first several issues that Fury gets temporarily reassigned to something else, and they bring in this other guy. And there's that to run things, and he's super hardcore by the book. And as soon as he shows up, and he's looking at these guys, you guys are sloppy, and you need a shave, and you're doing this, and you're doing that. Like as the reader, you get so defensive. These are your guys. You don't understand what we've all been through together. Okay. You're an outsider. Who do you think you are coming in when you don't know what these guys have been doing? And it's like, what? And I couldn't even guess how many words I've read at that point, but even if it's, 10 issues and a couple, so it's a couple hundred pages and maybe that many words total all along. And yet I'm completely invested. I know exactly who these guys are and how they do things and why they're, why they're special. And this outsider comes in. I just deeply resented this character, just as you're supposed to.
Yeah. Well, that's the beauty of episodic fiction in general is TV episodes or a comic book series is each individual moment you spend in their lives, each issue of the comic or each half hour of the sitcom or each hour of the drama probably isn't that deep, but cumulatively, they have a cumulative depth of world building and character building and power so that by the time you've spent 6 months, a year with these people, you feel like you know them and care about them.
Right. And it doesn't take... It takes a tremendous amount of skill, but it doesn't take that many words, doesn't take that much content to establish those characters.
And that's the beauty of comics is just a good cartoonist, a good comic book writer is just so economical. They just hit you with exactly what you need to know. And plus they're also relying on some real stereotypes. I mean, there's always a hayseed who's got freckles and there's always, the cool city guy who's, it may be full of bluster and they rely on some tropes, some stereotypes. You can't fault them for that because they've got a lot of exposition, a lot of introduction to do real quick.
Right. Yeah. And in the comics, for example, Fury, sort of Sergeant Fury in this instance is, you know, no matter what, he's the hardliner. He's the tough guy. And, you know, you guys think you need a break. Well, we're going to go, you know, do something twice as hard now. And, you know, always sort of yelling at everybody and, you know, they'll, you know, come on, you lunkheads, you know, do you want to live forever? This kind of thing. And this team of guys will do anything for him. And, you know, when he insults one of them directly, then that they're so flattered by the attention and things. And, you know, Dum Dum, who we see in this scene, you know, his big thing, I mean, aside from just being kind of a hulking giant of a man, is he'd so much rather be at war than at home dealing with his wife and mother-in-law. And it's like his mother-in-law in particular, like every line is this, you know, there's this mother-in-law thing. And it's like, he's...
Well, Jim, before we started recording, you had some interesting background on Dum Dum Dugan that I didn't know.
Well, he started out as a circus strongman. He kind of like, right. he intersects Nick Fury and is it Happy Sawyer? I can't remember the whoever Sawyer guy was. He's like the grim, he's like Nick Fury's boss. And he winds up saving these guys. He gets pulled in and then joins up with them. And the thing was, when he was a strongman in the circus, he wore a bowler hat while he was like lifting weights and rolling tigers around and stuff like that. So he kept the bowler as part of his uniform, and he was made a corporal. So he put the chevrons on his hat, and he's like, "I'm not losing the hat, my lucky hat." So, and when we, you know, the thing is, like at the time when you know in the '60s. You knew what dum-dums were. They weren't, it isn't, you're not calling him an idiot, although that, you know, it kind of like has the double meaning, but dum-dum is a type of bullet. It's a very destructive bullet. It came out of the dum-dum arsenal and the British masters of building weapons of destruction. You know, the Congreve rocket and the dum-dum all came out of India. And the dum-dum bullet, it goes in the front about, you know, the size of 0.303 inches, and it comes out the back and it's a foot and a half wide. And it's actually was outlawed by the Geneva Convention because you can't, that's where the phrase full metal jacket came from. You can't have a bullet that goes through and does that kind of damage that, you know, it'll kill you instantly. So
which does seem like it's the idea, but.
Yeah, okay. yeah. But, right. Well, the thing is, if you use a full metal jacket, you injure many, if you injure a soldier instead of kill him, you get three people off the battlefield. You get the guy that you hit and the two guys that have to carry him off. So full metal jacket bullets actually made the war a bigger attrition on the battlefield because you had more people leaving the battlefield at the time. So, you know, it's kind of a backwards way of thinking of things, but the dum-dum bullet was a lot more effective in killing, but less effective in removing people from the battlefield. But the idea that he was Dum Dum Dugan is what he was his own weapon of mass destruction. This guy, you know, as Hal was saying, he was this hulk of a man that would, you know, take apart people on the battlefield.
Well, and it was funny when I saw him in the film, and we talked about Neil McDonough being on the surface, an odd casting choice, but as soon as you see him on screen, as far as I'm concerned, he's perfect. Yeah. But it was funny because I remember seeing him and then thinking, you know, oh, that's good. He's not faking the British accent. And I was saying, and then I got thinking about it when going back and rereading or was getting ready to reread these things. Wait a minute. I'm not sure where I got the idea that Dugan was British other than the bowler hat. And that sort of, you know, bully mustache and big mutton chops and stuff, but he was actually British, I think, in the very first issue, and then very quickly they decided he was from Massachusetts.
Yeah, Boston, so, right?
Yeah.
Well, you want to talk about Neil McDonough a little bit, because he just, you know, when I first saw him come on the screen, my first impression wasn't, "Oh, there's Dum Dum Dugan." It didn't quite fit for me. But once he started talking and arguing with Fritz and had that twinkle in his eye, I'm like, all right, there he is. I got it.
There's the strength and stuff there.
The physical resemblance wasn't immediate for me, but the attitude was right.
And then certainly before the hat and the you know, the facial hair and whatever they did to sort of bulk him up. I mean, if you just look at his headshot, I don't think he's in the top 100 people you'd first think of to play that character out of the comics. But you know, it's a measure of a good actor. Kind of ironic that, you know, in his productions, Neil, he's famous for turning down roles that involve him needing to kiss somebody on screen, because he won't kiss anyone. That's not his wife. And they were finally in a picture together not too long ago. And it was his first on-screen kiss, you know, at age 60 or whatever he is. But interesting that's his particular, you know, commitment and the principle that he'd chosen to stand by. And he's playing this guy who in the comics would literally rather go to war than just hang around with his wife and mother-in-law. So,
buddy. It seems to me that'd be one of the perks of being an actor, wouldn't you think? I
mean, you said it's okay. It's just the job, right?
Just the job. Just doing my job, honey.
Honey, it's right here in the script. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Well.
Well. Good for him.
Yeah. It's and there's a lot more. The good thing is this is just the initial, the first little dipping your toe in on the Howling Commandos, and there's going to be a lot more of them later on in the show, which I appreciate the fact that the screenwriters had enough sense saying we've got a bunch of good characters here that we can use and introducing them we'll go over it in future minutes, but introducing them as different, even if it's only one or two sentences, you get the whole idea, as you were saying, Brian, you get the whole idea of what their backstory may be like. Right. And you know, things like Jim Morita is probably the earliest representation I can think in fiction of popular fiction of explaining about the Nisei legions that were, you know, coming out of Japanese prison camps in the West and fighting in the ETO. So it's there's a whole bunch of things. That's one of the things I remember about reading comics, is that it made you, before the internet, it made you go look things up, like, is that really happening? And then you go and look stuff up in a history book and go, oh, this is, I did not know about this. And, you know, people like Jack Kirby were able to introduce the next generation of kids. This is what was going on before you were born. And maybe it wasn't like it was in the comic books, but here's some of the issues that we were facing. And this is the things that we were talking about and thinking about and trying to sort out, and you know, they were still sorting it out a quarter of a century later.
Right. Yeah. Well, and they were, you know, and again, this is, you know, this comic set in the 40s, of course, created in that early 60s time frame. But this is, you know, by our modern definition, this is a very diverse group of people.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And, you know, from different countries, different races, and things. And it's just, we don't take a whole page with a big sign that says message, this is what we're trying to show you. It's just, here's a bunch of guys, and we establish out of the gate that these guys already have history, that they're the best at what they do. And you got all different kinds of people, and there's nobody's worried about it, and
And I think there's a subtle point to what you're saying that's a credit to Marvel and Stan Lee and Jack Kirby and all the early Marvel creators, which is that in other media, the minority characters were often used as tokens. They were, you know, the good black person or the good Asian person or the good Japanese person, and sometimes just horribly racist depictions. And I think of, you know, in comic strips, Milton Caniff in a strip called Terry and the Pirates. Wonderful, wonderful artist, terrific, but just in retrospect with the, you know, modern sensibilities, some horrifically racist stuff. Will Eisner, one of the giants of the business,
the spirit, had some
terribly you know, racist depictions of black supporting characters that he kind of carried on for years after it was not cool to do so. But Marvel in the Howling Commandos used those minority characters, they were just characters, and the minority-ness of them was, you know, a little sauce in the, or a little spice in the sauce, but it wasn't who they were. It wasn't what they were all about. They were there because they were competent Howling Commandos who happened to be black or Japanese or what have you.
I may be misremembering this, but was there a Native American character in the Howling Commandos that was wearing like the classic, you know, the Indian feather, or was that Sergeant Rock? I
think that would have been Sergeant Rock. I don't recall.
Yeah, I think you're right.
I think it was Sergeant Rock. It may be a DC thing. And I don't remember what the equivalent Howling Commandos was under Sergeant Rock, but I just remember, you know, fighting. He had a headband and a, you know, the single turkey feather on the back, and it's just like, what would he be doing that in a battle? Or just
well, why does Gabriel Jones blow his bugle all the time?
Yeah.
Why, when the commandos are sneaking up on somebody, do they have to all yell "Wahoo"? Because that's their howl.
Yeah.
You're thinking of a character named Little Sure Shot, who was in Sergeant Rock's Easy Company.
Okay, that's. Yeah, 8-year-old me trying to piece together what the there was an overlap at Jack's convenience store where I used to buy all my comics, and they four-sided. You have to peel past the Archies, and
you know, it's funny. I got brought this up before, at least maybe offline anyway. But you know, when it would go, and my buddy Eric and I would be hunting for Sergeant Fury and fleshing out our collections and stuff and reading. You know, this is 20 years or so after they were published. So we're finding them, you know, obviously finding them used in back issues and things. And then I remember picking up a couple of Sergeant Rock thing. Well, I like Sergeant Fury. I like this Sergeant Rock character. And I just remember being very put off, at least by the one that I picked up, because it's, you know, it's dead German soldier sprawled out on the battlefield in front, and he's all purple and gross and kind of bloated. And I just were thinking, this is too realistic. You know, I don't.
Yeah.
12-year-old me isn't loving this, so.
Wow. Yeah, I keep thinking I need to go out and get collections. I don't.
Yeah.
I need something in hardcover, because all of my if comic book collectors would look at me and shake their heads ruefully, because I don't keep them in a box in plastic. They're
bagged and boarded.
They're mostly just stacked up horizontally, and they slowly form that U shape as you stack them higher and higher, you know.
So, I respect that. Yeah. I respect that.
Let me just say they're well read. I don't look at them through, you know, through a big piece of polyurethane. Mine are well thumbed.
And, the way they're meant to be.
It's all right. So it's very good. But Brian, I have to tell you, I will never cut my Last Mechanical Monster out of the back of my personal copy. I will make a copy of it, and then I will cut it out.
No, I think you should buy another copy of the book. Cut up. Come on, Jim.
And then when you screw up cutting that one out, you got to buy another copy.
That's true. Yes.
And it's just off we go. Just
go to the
fee. So Brian's going to send you some very dull scissors as a gift.
Yes. The safety ones with the rounded edges. Yes.
See, because I created it, I have the PDF. I just print them out anytime I want. Like
he's got a whole army of.
Now there's some sort of mechanical monster inflation going on here. I don't know if I like this.
Exactly. Exactly.
Get that 200-pound card stock out. Yes. Wow. Well, I think we've beaten this one to death, but it's been a good episode, and we're looking forward to now as we're beginning the second hour of this movie. And we do have some characters coming up who are not us that we're going to be on the show. So please stay tuned for some more people that are coming. But I do thank you for being part of our show, listening in. If you'd like to continue the conversation, we're always available at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base on Facebook. If you do like our show, please don't forget to subscribe and leave a like at whatever podcast streaming service where you found this particular episode. Also, please check out our website, capminute.com. for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. And be sure to join us here next time for the Captain America Minute.
Do this all day.